One agrees on. Here is more. When on August 8, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, raided Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida in search of classified documents, the ex-president of the United States decried the episode as an assault that could only take place in broken third-world countries. He continued to lament that America had now become one of those countries corrupt at a level not seen before. Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., chimed in on Twitter with the assessment, "This is what you see happen in third-world banana republics. Never mind that the FBI seizure of secret documents does not fit the corruption bill quite as well as some other characteristics of American democracy. Say, the fact that non-taxpaying billionaires can be president or that the country is run as a crooked oligarchic corporatocracy." This is not the first time Trump has likened the United States of America to a third world country, which was also his epithet of choice when he lost the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden. But Trump and co. are not the only members of the U.S. ruling elite to exercise this vocabulary. The January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol prompted a surge in pejorative third world and banana republic comparisons from everyone, from Biden to George W. Bush, former U.S. leader, and civilized ravager of Afghanistan and Iraq. Indeed, it is impossible to understate the bipartisan imperial hubris that is on the display in the casual deployment of such lingo. By implicitly and unironically mocking underdeveloped nations, the U.S. political establishment appears to have conveniently forgotten the country's own historical role in creating the banana republic phenomenon in the first place and in ensuring that the third world remains, you know, third. The term banana republic was coined in 1904 by American writer O. Henry in reference to the Central American nation of Honduras, which, like neighboring Guatemala, was an early victim of predatory U.S. capitalism and corporate exploitation. The economic and physical well-being of the inhabitants of such lowly nations was naturally of no concern to the hemispheric behemoth, which ensured its unfettered access to regional resources by backing right-wing coups, bloody civil wars, corrupt dictatorships, and death squads. In other words, stuff that was slightly more devastating than an FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. The Cold War, of course, provided a handy alibi for U.S.-backed killing worldwide, from Nicaragua to Angola, while also spawning the Third World designation that would go on to accrue patronizing connotations. Once the menace had been replaced with terrorist menace as the primary U.S. excuse for lethal international interference, the remaining global superpower continued to extend a charitable hand to the impoverished third world, often via a form of corporate neocolonialism cast as development. And while Trump's recent tantrum about the U.S. as a broken third-world country can certainly be filed under expansive category of distastefully cookie things, Trump has said, there is also an unintended element of truth to it. Like it or not, the United States of America fits the third world stereotype in many respects, and not just in terms of its oligarchic style of governance. The United States advertises itself as being at the vanguard of global development, but the nation's healthcare, poverty, and other indicators suggest a policy of willful counter-development instead. Back in 2017, Philip Olson, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, visited the U.S. for 2 weeks. At the end of his trip, he issued a statement on how he found the country exceptional in ways that are shockingly at odds with its immense wealth and its founding commitment to human rights. Despite managing to spend more money on national defense than China, Russia, the UK, and a bunch of other big spenders combined, the U.S. had some 40 million people living in poverty amid glaring contrast between private wealth and public squalor. As Alston noted, the U.S. was also alone among developed countries in insisting that human rights did not include rights that guard against dying of hunger, dying from a lack of access to affordable health care, or growing up in a context of total deprivation. So much for that line from the U.S. Declaration of Independence about inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's hard to pursue anything if you're dead. Speaking of death, infant mortality rates in the U.S. are higher than in Cuba, an island that has spent more than 60 years under suffocating U.S. embargo. Trump himself imposed no fewer than 243 new sanctions against Cubans as punishment for their crime of pursuing national sovereignty over the banana republic model. And for good measure, threw Cuba back on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism, as the United States baselessly claims. Back in the land of the free, meanwhile, homelessness has reached ghastly levels unseen even in many underdeveloped countries, and the U.S. has long maintained the highest incarceration rate in the world, although it may have recently been surpassed by El Salvador, another place where U.S. support for human rights has involved backing right-wing state terror. Such is the ironic nature of imperial power, it seems, that the global hegemon responsible for oppressing much of the third world must also keep a significant portion of its own populace in third world conditions. As per Trump's twisted logic, any attempt to hold him accountable for anything is evidence that the U.S. is a corrupt and broken third world country. And while there is no sense in wasting time on Trumpian delusion, we might nonetheless take the opportunity to recall that old saying about the broken clock and to acknowledge that the United States of America is definitively broken.
As humans, the Earth is our home. It is the only home we have. The Earth is where we live, breathe, eat, and raise the future generation. Our entire life support system is dependent on the well-being of our natural environment and all of the species living on this beautiful blue planet. But what have we done to it? How have we preserved it? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Unfortunately, our planet is in grave danger. Many species of animals and plants are nearing extinction. Our clean air and water supply is at risk, and more of our beautiful open spaces are disappearing as new buildings and factories are built. What is worse is that the Earth is getting warmer and warmer as we speak. This week's exclusive documentary explores the perilous state of our planet. Stay with us for the first part.
Issue their tsunami warning.
Gives us a clear idea of what's happening.
The cloud is now moving south. It's harmless to people on the
ground. Covered with thousands of miles, why doesn't that energy dissipate?
The Earth isn't feeling well.
That is a year.
Its fever has risen, and its situation is getting worse by the day.
Nowadays, we hear people saying the Earth's temperature is rising.
The average temperature of the Earth was about 15 degrees Celsius in the beginning of the 20th century. During the Ice Age, the average temperature of the Earth was only 5 degrees less. Take into consideration this 15 degrees and compare it to the 10 degree average during the Ice Age. Now, if this 15 degrees, God forbid, reaches 19 or 20 degrees, what age could you call that? The ebullient age? Naturally, the subsistence of life will end way before the ebullient age.
Of course, the Earth has other problems as well, but climate change or global warming is a major problem, which increases the frequency of droughts, storms, and other consequences and natural disasters that take place on the Earth's surface.
The existence of icebergs in the north and south poles cause reflection of solar energy, which is known as albedo. Without an ice cover, this energy will be absorbed by the Earth's surface and accelerate global warming, altering the average temperature on planet Earth. We can say the Earth has a fever. It may be 1 degree or 1 2/100 degrees.
There's a very simple formula. Q is heat energy, which is equal to the mass of substance multiplied by C, which is a specific heat capacity multiplied by delta T. A 2-degree delta T, for instance, is multiplied by a huge mass at a specific heat capacity, which sums up to what? A very large Q. And what does that all mean? It means that all these signals I'm giving you are alarming. And it means that I'm continuously moving from the green line into the orange and red lines and into the danger zone.
Greenhouse gases are gases that can trap wavelengths larger than 4 microns within themselves. These are wavelengths that are radiated to the Earth from the Sun, and when reflected from the surface of the Earth, elements become trapped within the wavelengths. They trap greenhouse gases and absorb heat, which leads to the gradual warming of the Earth.
Just like inside a greenhouse, as in the ones used for farming, when solar radiation penetrates into it, the trapped heat is not completely removed, and it causes the inside of the greenhouse to become warmer than the outside. Greenhouse gases play the same role in the Earth's atmosphere.
Greenhouse gases per se are very useful. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which we usually refer to as carbon dioxide, is very useful because without these gases, the temperature of the Earth would fall to minus 19 degrees Celsius. Minus 19 degrees Celsius means a total freeze. It means no agricultural or farming product would be able to grow. Obviously, it wouldn't provide the requirements for human existence on the Earth. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the partial trapping of energy reflections from the Earth have caused the Earth's temperature to rise to 15 degrees Celsius. In other words, greenhouse gases have caused a 34 degree temperature rise. This process has obviously created the ideal situation we have for all living creatures to thrive. A forest is one factor responsible for absorbing greenhouse gases. It is necessary for soaking up greenhouse gases. Unfortunately, forests around the world are being brutally desecrated for their wood and their land. You can see many instances of deforestation around the world. Deforestation has taken place to enable farming, but also for building factories and cities. When these forests are destroyed, the global sources for absorbing greenhouse gases are weakened. With the proliferation of greenhouse gases and the increase of human activities on the surface of the Earth, which has provided the growth and spread of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the basis for absorbing and trapping thermal energy that is reflected from the surface of the Earth is further provided in the atmosphere.
The atmosphere's capacity for greenhouse gases is 2,900 gigatons. And until now, in the year 2010, about 65% of its capacity has been emitted. So from 2010 until the year 2100, the atmosphere only has the capacity to handle another 35%.
And obviously, the basis has been provided for the Earth's average temperature of 15 degrees to rise to 15.5, 15.7, or 15.9 degrees, and even to 16 degrees at times.
از این 1900 گیگاتون منتشر شده در کل جهان در
اتمسفر. A large portion of the 1900 gigatons emitted into the atmosphere.
belongs to countries which have caused more emissions starting from the 1840s and 1850s. Developing countries with 81% of the world's population have only emitted 26% of these gases.
Therefore, we're facing a very serious humanitarian hazard, and we need to take serious measures to stop the emission of greenhouse gases.
Progress is being made, however. Beijing authorities are closing factories and outlawing burning coal for heating.
Naturally, a rise in the average temperature of the surface of the Earth from moderate levels can have bad consequences, and temperatures higher than that can pave the way for various disasters on the Earth's surface.
We're working in a totally unsustainable way. We do things to feel at ease, but we only have one planet Earth. We can't later immigrate and leave this planet. If we destroy it, where else can we go? This is it. And the destruction we're causing with technological development is enough to put our lives at risk now. As a human being, I'd ask, what sort of technological development have we accomplished? What sort of technology have we achieved? Or what have we done for human comfort that hasn't harmed us in any way? Give me one example.
The skyline is littered with factories, and toxic smoke pours into the air day and night. For those living here, it's a choice between pollution.
A federal appeals court upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's emission standards for hazardous air pollutants from coal and oil-fired power plants. The court rejected state and industry challenges to rule
the
scientific
lawmaker in the European Parliament said reducing supply in the CO2 trading market would boost prices.
What does it mean to live in a polluted place? It means that particles, say 5 microns, 2.5 microns and 1 micron increase. Carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide increase. Now it depends on the quality of the gasoline and the gas that you use. The sulfur and nitrogen derivatives, ozone and finally soot and particulates all scatter in the air and they eventually enter the body either through the nose or the mouth.
So body cells that start from the nose, eyes and mouth and reach the depth of the lungs are all affected, and these substances enter the bloodstream through the respiratory system.
It affects the brain. We become tired fast. We become impatient. We quickly lose our temper and verbally assault each other. There's no need for one to be ill. Those who are ill are at greater risk.
We see B2B, business to business. Just business to business. It's usually called B2B. This is a disaster. Even if it means death and costs us our lives, which is our most important index, we have a brain. We don't use it. The only thing we see in business is the money. Everything depends on how deep one's pockets are.
Everything is with jibe.
Development is a natural process in human growth, which has existed for thousands of years. It's now been accelerated, becoming faster and stranger. But during this development process, some of us have become rich. Some are filling up their bank accounts and becoming wealthy. It's interesting, though, that these same people, sometimes directly, but most times indirectly, have to somehow return this money.
The oil leaked for 87 days, the worst offshore spill in U.S. history. BP was later found to be grossly negligent for the explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon platform. And today, it agreed to a settlement that will include a $5.5 billion fine for violations of the Clean Water Act, $7.1 billion to the U.S. government and five states to repair coastlines smeared by oil, $4.9 billion to settle economic claims by those five states, and up to $1 billion to 400 local governments. Louisiana, the most heavily damaged, gets almost $7 billion, the biggest share.
This is by no means chance and accident. Our experience in development over the past 100 or 200 years shows that technological advancement and city living have been the cause of this. Name any technology you like, or whatever has made human existence easier, and you'll find it's harmed the environment.
China has announced the successful containment of its worst ever reported oil spill, although much work remains to be done before an ongoing cleanup is complete. At a media briefing, the vice mayor of the northeastern coastal city of Dalian, where the spill occurred, said workers had used more than 40 kilometers of oil barriers and 65 tons of absorbent pads to stop the slick reaching international waters. Yet with oil remaining on beaches and in the water, he also acknowledged a full cleanup will be an arduous task.
Go back 160 years in time to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the industrial age in the 1850s, to see an impact.
It's been about a century that we humans have opted for consumerism on the earth, and as we have moved forward in recent decades, consumer demand has risen.
Until a point, we lived along with the earth and the nature. From a point onwards, we just forgot about what the earth is, where it's come from, and where this kind of usage will lead us to. We just want everything. The high consumer demand that we're witnessing these days is just destroying the earth's natural resources.
But a leading scientist suggests the reasons for the drought may be even more worrying for Brazil in the long run. Has continued deforestation in the Amazon and in the Atlantic forest drastically altered the climate?
We created the packaging industry to be able to easily relocate food products and conserve them for longer periods, so we would be able to keep a packet of food or fruit juice for, say, 2 weeks without it being spoiled. What's been the outcome? Go take a look at the landfills to see what we've done to the earth by producing all this garbage. Garbage that can't be recycled. It was done for our comfort, but it's also put our future in danger.
If we move back a few decades, there were a limited number of countries that were consumer-based and that used a lot of energy and products like the United States and in Europe. But these days, global consumption on Earth has sharply increased as countries in East Asia, especially China, have started boosting their consumption.
About 56% of these greenhouse gases are produced by fossil fuels.
سوخت‌های فسیلی.
Naturally, the rise in the use of fossil fuels is due to energy requirements of machines used for ever-expanding development projects. To boost the machine age, the industrial age. Due to this boosting process, the developed world has had to increase its use of different kinds of fossil fuels. This has paved the way for partial deforestation, which aims to provide the agricultural requirements to cover total food needs of a growing global population. This causes change to the optimal 15-degree world average temperature.
In the northeastern prefecture of Miyagi, and what you're looking at right now on the screen is in the city of Sendai.
A couple of feet of water, so they have to stand out there until they can manage to get the boat across and then take a big group of them into an entrance ramp of ice.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to Child Poverty Action Group, already 800,000 children living in poverty in England do not qualify for free school meals. And now head teachers are bracing for rising numbers from homes that cannot afford to feed them properly. We have prepared for you an article written by Anna Fazakerley. The piece is titled Fears of Widespread Child Hunger Spark Calls for Universal Free School Meals in UK. Hunger will be the biggest single challenge UK schools face as children return to classrooms in the coming weeks, sparking calls for the government to introduce universal free school meals to help tackle the crisis. According to Child Poverty Action Group, already 800,000 children living in poverty in England do not qualify for free school meals. And now head teachers are bracing for rising numbers from homes that cannot afford to feed them properly. Paul Gosling, head of Exeter Road Community Primary School in Exmouth in Devon, said, "Last winter, I already had a group of children who stood around the radiator outside my office every morning because they had no heating on at home and needed to warm up." He added, "We will have far more children turning up to school hungry." Paul Gosling, who is president of the National Association of Head Teachers Union, said his school was worrying about how to afford to keep the lights on, let alone helping families, but claimed he would not let any child stay hungry. Johnny Utley, the chief executive officer of the Education Alliance Academy Trust, which runs 7 schools in Hull and East Riding, said, "This food poverty is the single biggest challenge schools will face. More and more children will turn up to school hungry. It will go well beyond the definition of free school meals now." He added that even before the horrific energy cap crisis, he was planning measures such as breakfast clubs and uniform vouchers because of rising poverty in his schools. But now the potential scale of the problem is so much worse. In England, all infant school children are entitled to free school meals from reception to year two. But beyond that, only children whose parents earn less than £7,400 a year are eligible. But the rise in the price cap for the average gas and electricity bill to £3,549 a year from October will mean many who earn more than this amount will face a stark choice between food and heating. It took a campaign by Manchester United and England footballer Marcus Rashford to force Prime Minister Boris Johnson into a U-turn on extending free school meals to the lowest income families during school holidays in November of 2020. The reversal came after a storm of criticism from charities, the opposition and media from both sides of the political divide. This summer, the British government again funded local authorities to offer eligible children a free meal a day and free activities under its holiday activities and food programme. But Labour Party has slammed this for being a part-time initiative that operates just 4 days a week for 4 weeks during the summer holiday, leaving children hungry for the rest of the time. Charities are angry that the threshold for free school meals has not changed since 2018, despite soaring inflation. Johnny Utley, the CEO of Education Alliance Academy Trust, believes the government needs to introduce universal free school meals because so many families will be in desperate need despite falling outside of the government's poverty threshold. He claimed the government did an extraordinary thing with furlough in the pandemic because it had to. It is difficult to see that child hunger isn't as important as that and doesn't require as radical a level of thinking. Richard Murphy, economic justice campaigner and professor of accounting at Sheffield University, said free school meals for all children in state schools was the only possible solution. He said, "Within months, we will be facing the worst economic crisis that anyone alive has witnessed," adding, "The government must move rapidly and universally, as the cost of not doing so is not just child poverty, but child hunger, and that cannot be acceptable." The Welsh Government has committed to rolling out free school meals for all primary school children by 2024, and ministers have said they will try to bring this forward. Ahead of the last Holyrood election, the Scottish National Party pledged to provide a free breakfast and lunch to all primary-age children by August of this year, although this has not yet been achieved. A single mother in Tyne and Wear who spoke to The Observer on the condition of anonymity said that although she is on universal credit and frightened about juggling food and bills this winter, her two sons are not entitled to free school meals at their primary school because she earns £728 a month working part-time in education administration. She said, "We already have thermals and fleece pyjamas so we can avoid putting the heating on in our home. The kids have free swimming lessons, which we have factored in as a hair washing day to avoid running a bath at home." She said, "The cap for free school meals is far too low," adding, "Apparently, we're poor, but not poor enough." Andy Jolly, a former school governor and campaigner for free school meals, said, "It's incredibly difficult to become eligible for free school meals. A lot of people who have lost their jobs, who you would have imagined must be eligible, just aren't." He added, "Registration isn't automatic. Parents have to tell the school and then go through a complicated process to apply. Often because of barriers such as language or fear of stigma, families don't claim." A spokesperson for the Department of Education said, More than 2,000 schools are currently signed up to the National School Breakfast Programme, claiming we're investing up to £24 million in the programme and expanded eligibility in January to reach more schools in disadvantaged areas. The spokesperson said, we're also providing 1.9 million children with free school meals, as well as welfare support for families in need through the Household Support Fund. Moreover, the United Nations has said the number of people going hungry in the world has risen by 150 million people since the start of the COVID pandemic, warning that the food crisis sparked by Russia-Ukraine conflict risks pushing the worst-hit countries into famine. A report has found globally the number suffering from chronic undernourishment rose to as many as 828 million last year, a rise of about 46 million under the previous year, and three times that increase if measured since the world shut down due to the COVID pandemic. With the price of fuel, food staples and fertilizers soaring since the Russia's special operation in Ukraine, however, the total is expected to rise even further in the next year, a scenario that could see some of the world's poorest fall into famine, the most extreme form of food deprivation. Due to the uncertainty caused by the lingering impact of COVID shutdowns, the report released recently is unable to give a precise figure for the number of people going hungry in 2022, instead estimating that the total was somewhere between 702 million and 828 million. The report said an estimated 45 million children under the age of 5 were suffering from wasting, the deadliest form of malnutrition, which increases children's risk of death by up to 12 times. About 149 million children under the age of 5 had stunted growth and development due to a chronic lack of essential nutrients.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. O human, religion will never tell you not to rush. It will never tell you to stay at home and rest. It will never ever tell you not to use your energy. Anyone who tells you this in the name of religion is either ignorant or a liar. True religion never tells you to leave your energies idle. True religion tells you to do your utmost, to do your best, but to what end? True religion tells you to use your energy for something worthy of you, not for a bit of water and dirt, not for some paltry price, not for some worldly existence which, no matter how grand it is, will always be small for you. O human, strive for something that is worthy of your magnificence and equal to your stature. The human being is the greatest being in the cosmos, the most magnificent wonder of existence, second only to God, and yet it inhabits this tiny and limited form. O human, strive, make haste, but towards what? Towards your Lord's forgiveness in a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth. Strive for a paradise that is so great that it makes the heavens seem small and the earth seem insignificant. What does this mean? Pay close attention to the Quran's words so that you may understand. The Quran says, if you want to aim for something, the heavens and the earth are not worthy of you. They are small for you. So aim for something greater than these. O human, God's forgiveness is important for you. God's forgiveness is higher than everything else. And after forgiveness, there is something whose value and magnificence is greater than the heavens and the earth combined.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, what does forgiveness mean? We think it is when we say to someone, I apologize, I was rude to you, please forgive me. And that person, whether with kindness and magnanimity or in any other form, says, that's okay, don't worry about it. We think it means when we do something wrong by accident and we go to the person we wronged and ask for forgiveness, I'm sorry, please forgive me, and he says, that's okay, I forgive you. We think it means when we go to a government office because you've been overcharged on your taxes and you ask them kindly to help you solve your problem. Perhaps you take someone with you or a letter or ask someone to call on your behalf and they say, okay, we will refund you such and such an amount. This is how we imagine God's forgiveness. Someone does something wrong, they caused corruption in the earth and were worthy of God's punishment. Then on the day of judgment, because of a tear they shed or a plea they made, God will say, that's okay, I forgive you. Is that what we mean by God's forgiveness? Does this sound like something we're supposed to hasten towards? No, of course not.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday, 30th of September, refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and the impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Stay with us for the world media's coverage of this story. Britain's Guardian newspaper tells us more. Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng have refused to release independent analysis of their tax plans until more than 6 weeks after receiving them, despite more calls from Tory MPs for Downing Street to reassure the markets. The Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer said they would only publish the independent forecasts on 23rd of November alongside a fiscal statement, despite them being ready on 7th of October. Several Conservative MPs have already urged Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng to allow the Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, Britain's independent fiscal watchdog, to reveal its forecast as soon as possible, including Conservative MP Mel Stride, the chair of the Treasury Committee. Peter Alders, another Tory MP, said on Friday that the fiscal plan with new rules should be brought forward. Writing for the House of Commons magazine, he said, "Time is running out to show the British people that the Conservative Party deserves to retain the honour of serving as their government." Another Tory MP, Charles Walker, conceded the party had lost the next election and said the government had a duty to the country to get the public finances in the best possible shape before it is lost. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng do not appear to be bowing to pressure from their own party. The pair met the chair of the Office of Budget Responsibility, Richard Hughes, on Friday, 30th of September, after a week of turmoil in the financial markets, in response to Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget promising tax cuts funded by borrowing, without any accompanying independent growth forecasts. After the mini-budget, the British pound plunged, mortgage rates soared, and the Bank of England had to stage an emergency £65 billion intervention to bail out pension funds. The Treasury has been facing calls from its select committee to allow the Office of Budget Responsibility to release forecasts earlier to reassure the financial markets, to reassure the public and the Parliament that the government's plan will lead to higher growth. However, Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng appear to be holding firm against that idea. The pound, which hit a one-week high at 1.1235 for US dollar at 10 a.m. on Friday, has dipped back into negative territory against the dollar. It is currently trading 0.1% lower at $1.11. The Treasury said Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng and Richard Hughes had discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecast, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook. They agreed, as is usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process and beyond, it said. The Prime Minister and Chancellor reaffirmed their commitment to the independent Office of Budget Responsibility and made clear that they value its scrutiny. Following the meeting, the Office of Budget Responsibility confirmed its forecast would be ready to deliver to the Chancellor on 7th of October and would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of the government's policies. In a statement after the meeting, which appears to last less than 50 minutes, the Office of Budget Responsibility said, "We discussed the economic and fiscal outlook and the forecasts we are preparing for the Chancellor's medium-term fiscal plan." In interviews on Friday, Liz Truss showed no sign of rowing back from the controversial mini-budget. She also insisted there could have been a full forecast produced by the Office of Budget Responsibility in time for last week's fiscal event, even though the public finance watchdog said it had prepared interim figures that were ready to be published. In that timescale, there couldn't be a full Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, but we are committed to the Office of Budget Responsibility forecast, she said. We're working together with the OBR. There will be an event on 23rd of November where the policies are fully analysed by the Office of Budget Responsibility. The Reuters news agency tells us more about the same story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng on Friday refused to bow to demands to publish an early forecast of government growth plans and impact of planned tax cuts, which have led to turmoil in the financial markets. Kwasi Kwarteng unveiled a string of lower taxes last week that were unusually not accompanied by forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility. A resulting sell-off led to the Bank of England to intervene with emergency bond buying to protect pension funds from partial collapse. Kwasi Kwarteng has come under pressure to allay market fears and bring forward a fiscal statement planned for 23rd of November, when he has said he would publish the Office of Budget Responsibility forecasts and detail the costs of the debt-financed tax cuts, along with a path to lower debt in the medium term. However, after Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng met the Office of Budget Responsibility's chair, Richard Hughes, on Friday, the Finance Ministry said the timing of Kwarteng's medium-term fiscal plan was unchanged. They discussed the process for the upcoming economic and fiscal forecasts, which will be published on 23rd of November, and the economic and fiscal outlook, the Treasury confirmed in a statement. They agreed, as usual, to work closely together throughout the forecast process. The Office of Budget Responsibility said the first draft will be delivered to Kwasi Kwarteng on 7th of October, and it would, as always, be based on our independent judgment about economic and fiscal prospects and the impact of government's policies. The watchdog had said on Thursday it had offered to produce an analysis for Kwasi Kwarteng's tax-cutting plan, but were not commissioned to do so. A senior parliamentary committee has joined those urging Kwasi Kwarteng to bring forward his November statement to calm financial markets, echoing calls from other lawmakers in the ruling Conservative Party. Andrew Griffith, the minister who oversees the City of London financial district, earlier said the projections should not be rushed. "We all want the forecast to be done as quickly as possible, as the Office of Budget Responsibility can, but also you also want them to have the right level of detail." Liz Truss, who only replaced Boris Johnson as Prime Minister this month, has argued that the market turbulence is a result of global problems caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that she will stick to her plans to snap the economy out of years of stagnant growth. Liz Truss also says the government had to intervene to provide support to help people and businesses with their energy bills, a package that the government said would cost about £60 billion for the next 6 months in order to keep a typical British household's bill to under £2,500 a year. Official data showed on Friday that Britain's economy grew in the second quarter but was still below its pre-pandemic peak. Critics have said Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng should have included forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility to reassure financial markets about where the funding would come from before announcing their proposed £45 billion tax cuts.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A recent report by the Pentagon says 12 civilians were killed in drone strikes during 2021 in Afghanistan. Two were killed in separate airstrikes in Herat and Kandahar, and 10 members of a family in a drone operation in Kabul just before the U.S. withdrawal. Although General McKenzie admitted that the incident was a mistake, but none of the U.S. military forces went on trial for this attack. The report also compares the number of casualties in 2021 and 2020. It shows there is a decrease, but those aren't the only years the U.S. was present in Afghanistan. The United States came to Afghanistan in 2001 and left the country in 2021. Armed drones were used by the U.S. military from the beginning. Still, there